The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today James Lee Burke. He joins us on the telephone out in Montana. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Vic. How you doing?
Jim, I have been looking forward to this interview. I was hoping to talk to you in May, and your book got delayed for the reasons that so many things have been getting delayed, and I'm so glad that it's out now.
Well, yes, it was a delayed, about 3 months, I believe, but... Yes, I think it's doing quite well.
The book is called A Private Cathedral. And, Jim, I went back and I went through my notes, and I see that this is interview number 19 for us.
Yeah, that sounds about right. About 20 years or so.
This is a book that you've kind of inserted as like a flashback trilogy. This is the third book in a trilogy. The first Dave Robichaux book came out in what, 1987?
That's correct. The okay. First Robichaux book was 87.
And the time frame on these, you're going back at least 20, 25 years for these three books, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And is there a reason why you wanted to set them before, say, 9/11?
Yes, in particular, or it's around that time, but I would say, yes, it's before 9/11. The trilogy, the last three books, that's Robichaux, the title of the book is Robichaux, The New Iberia Blues and A Private Cathedral, they deal with the coming of a dark figure, somewhere fellow waiting on the wings of the stage, and in the third book he is arriving, but at the same time this character, a terrible man from the Inquisition, or he worked for the Inquisition, teleports himself from the year 1600 into contemporary affairs. But it's a classical tale, actually, that the story of Isolde and Tristan, but most of my work actually has its origin in classical literature or mythology.
And they're mostly rooted in the Arthurian legends and in the Song of Roland.
That's it. That's it. That's what it's all about, the greatest story in the history of the Western world.
And if we look at the Robichaux's, we need to toss in that first great novel by Don Quixote.
Yeah, that's the idealist, of course, and then his sidekick, Sancho Panza. Yeah, just the trickster right out of medieval folklore.
You've mentioned in some previous writing that your prototypes for this dark figure were inspired by people like Huey Long, George Wallace, and Joseph McCarthy.
That's it. It's an aggregate of the three men. That's the figure that's been waiting for us, I think. And he may have different names, but that, I believe, has been a creature that is hovering right on the edge of much of our history. Goes back to the 1830s, the nativist movement.
This entity that you mentioned that sort of teleported from the 16th century, you call him Gideon. And,
yeah.
And when I read this story, I've read so many of your crime novels, and when I read this one, I said to myself, he is going into the realms of dark fantasy and even horror with this character.
Well, that's true, and the story begins, at least in Dave's mind, when he first addresses the reader, and he looks out on the Gulf of Mexico at night, and he sees it in a Homeric way. He sees the the waves are wine dark. But what he's really looking at is the nature of evil. That's what very often is the question, I think, when we have some years on the odometer. Where does it come from? Namely, human cruelty. How can certain things exist in some people, and how is it that we sometimes empower them and actually seek their authority? And I've never answered the question. Never. Never have understood it.
But you continue to try to work it out.
Well, I guess so. You got to do something. That was an expression in the 50s.
Yeah. An expression from down south somewhere?
Oh, I don't know. I was just back in the 50s is one of those golden eras like the 20s. Those two decades, actually, they're very similar. They're the ones for which we're always nostalgic.
Even though if we really went back there, it wasn't so wonderful, actually, was it?
Oh, probably not. I mean, depends on, you know, which window you look into, but it was the McCarthy era. Demagogues in denim were, you know, down south and, mm-hmm. you know, very active, and a lot of bad things happened. But the Korean War, of course, the McCarthy investigations.
And in the 20s, you had this frenzied rush to collapse by 1929.
That was the end of the era, and people were living, you know, actually on not real money, but money that was really, I guess, waiting to go up in flames, and the stock market went down in 29. Of course, the Great Dust Bowl occurred, the storms of 31.
That sounds
but anyway, I mean, it's the nature of things.
Yeah.
But I think the times we're in now are our most perilous. They're an extension of certain things that occurred in the 50s. Namely, we became a neo-colonial power. We are walking in the footprints of the British and the French, and I think we'll come to the same end. I think that's where we are now.
I saw where you recalled going back to 1948 when Strom Thurmond ran his third-party political campaign.
Yeah.
And you actually were involved in an activity involving Strom Thurmond. I'm fascinated by this because I'm picturing you seeing for maybe one of the first times where we were headed.
Well, yeah, I sold barbecue tickets for his rally door to door, but I was 11 years old. But anyway, he was, of course, running on the Dixiecrat ticket. But that era, of course, the post-war era, was one that of great change. And this is my perception of it. You see, after the war, Harry Truman integrated the army, and he also empowered tenant farmers in the South, mostly black tenant farmers, to borrow money from the government, I think, at 1% interest, $10,000 loans for 1% interest, and it broke the back of the plantation system.
Oh.
And so that violence that occurred in the resurgence here again of racism and the Klan, it all had to do with economics.
Mm. In case you're just joining us, my guest is James Lee Burke, and his latest Dave Robichaux novel, the third book in a trilogy, is called A Private Cathedral. Set the scene in this one, Jim. Tell our listeners just the basic outline on this, obviously without telling them too much.
Well, it's a story set in just before 9/11, and Dave Robichaux and his friend Cleet Purcell get involved with a family in New Orleans, one that is descended from a Renaissance family, but they're gangsters, and another group that also comes from the same era, and they're two feuding families that very much like, oh, the classical figures we find in the story of Tristan and Isolde, and also Romeo and Juliet. But the feud is one that takes on far more sinister aspirations than just simply the desire for power. It seems this is figure, that he's this person there in New Iberia, the patriarch of this family, is a truly wicked man who has learned how to manipulate the electorate. And he understands weaknesses in people, vulnerability, but most of all, he knows how to spread division.
Mm. And Dave and Cleet are drawn into this inexorably. Cleet, we need to talk a little bit about Cleet because he's just such a wonderful character. And Cleet came from some very difficult circumstances. He was abused when he was a boy, and he's the kind of guy, if he detects someone around him who he thinks abuses women or children, Cleet's ready to kill him right on the spot.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he's... He remembers the brutal childhood he had. His father was an alcoholic milkman who used to whip him with a razor strop and make him kneel all night on rice grains he'd scatter on the kitchen linoleum floor. And there's that bruise on Cleet's soul that makes him oftentimes get out of control when he deals with people who are cruel to children or to women.
And Dave and Cleet are so devoted to one another.
That's right.
If one of them's in trouble, the other will do whatever he can. I remember in a recent book that Dave was willing to mortgage everything just to try to get Cleet out of a debt.
That's right. Yes. They're opposite sides of a coin. One is the idealist, the other is the trickster. You know, the medieval trickster I mentioned a moment ago. But Cleet, every high school has one fella like Cleet. If people listening to this think back, remember that one person in high school who would do anything.
Uh-huh. I do.
He would be used to get even with other people.
Oh, my. Well, I try to pick up on little things when I read your books, Jim. And at one point, Dave comes into this woman's house, and he sees that she's watching a movie, and it's Shane. And Dave points out that screenplay was written by A.B. Guthrie, and I met him one time in Montana, and I thought to myself, is this cameo appearance by James Lee Burke, did you meet A.B. Guthrie one time?
Oh, yeah. He was a friend of ours.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He was a really fine gentleman. He was a great writer. He is one of the most ignored great writers in American literature, like John Neihardt. I mean, the two books, The Way West and The Big Sky, are epic. I would compare them with Homer. The Big Sky is just a thunderstorm. For the life of me, I cannot understand the way he was pushed aside, I guess. But anyway, he was a fine gentleman, but boy, he was a beautiful writer. And he was one of the people who promoted my work early on in my career.
Well, I have to thank you, Jim, because I went back and I read those books, and they are just incredible.
That's it. They're incredible. And he was a newspaper editor, I think, in Louisville.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, he I don't think he published fiction until he was in his 40s.
Well, at one point, I believe Jim is dropping by the house of this same woman who he's romantically interested in. In fact, he's romantically interested in a couple of women in this story. But this one particular woman, he comes to her door, and she greets him and addresses him as cowboy. And this really rang a bell with me because I had the writer Don Winslow on the show recently, and he was talking about how the crime novel really was spawned by the Western. Do you have any comment on that?
He's absolutely correct. It actually comes from the work of James Fenimore Cooper. It goes back to Natty Bumppo and The Last of the Mohicans. But it's the existential it is the definitive existential American story. The man with no last name, going westward, always seeking something over on the western horizon. But that's this, and Jack, is it Schrader who wrote Shane? Was that his name?
I don't know, Jim.
Very good writer. He, I think, did most of the dialogue, or a lot of the dialogue, with Bud. A.B. Guthrie's nickname was Bud. And they wrote what is considered the best American Western film ever written. But it's more than just a Western film. It's the little boy yelling Shane's name, and you hear it, his voice echoing in the Grand Teton Mountains, this little voice, and the chalice has been passed to the little boy by Shane. It's, again, it's the Arthurian story.
And we're always...
It is a great film. Oh, gee, and Jack Wilson, the villain played by Jack Palance.
Mm.
Boy, Jack Palance will give you nightmares for days. It's a great film. Golly, I watch it all the time.
Do you?
It shows on it. We have a cable. Was it Turner Classics?
Uh huh.
And I've seen it many times, and it breaks your heart.
I know you had that long period where you were out of print, but you're durable, Jim. You never quit. It's almost like you were chosen by some mystical entity to just keep on pushing.
Well, that's a very fine compliment. I hope that's the case. But that's very nice. I appreciate it.
I also am fascinated by your characters that are sociopaths. And I understand that early in your career, you have had all these jobs, and at one point, I think you were a social worker in Los Angeles, and you actually encountered some people who were probably sociopaths.
Well, yeah, I was a social worker in Los Angeles and often worked with parolees, but they were just, most of them were just inept, sort of comic, dysfunctional people. The peculiarity of prisons is that most of the people inside them are not much different from the rest of us. They mess up things more than anything else. Banana peels for fingers. That's what I always think of with most of these guys. The real psychopaths stay in lockdown, and they are as treated as a separate entity by the general population. But the most dangerous people, the ones who have do the most harm, not people I met who are incarcerated, it's out there in the real world. They're far more dangerous.
Mm.
And a sociopath, is incapable of empathy, and they're often very intelligent, and they have one common attribute. They seek power over others.
Oh.
But they're all around us. I mean, I've known many people. I don't have any doubt about it at all. They have no conscience whatsoever. They sleep well, you know. But they aspire always to power, the acquisition of power.
Jim, I had a writer on the show recently who mentioned a writer that I have not read, and I plan to. And he said, and this was Lawrence Block speaking, he said that Charles Williford had written a memoir in which he essentially admitted that he was a sociopath. Now, didn't you once teach in a college that was associated with a college he was teaching at in Florida?
We were friends over 20 years. I knew Charles real well. I knew Charles wasn't a sociopath.
No? No. Okay, I was struck by this. I wondered why Lawrence Block would say this.
I know Larry, and Larry's a really fine man. I never heard Larry say that, but I knew Charles. Charles was, oh, golly, Moses. Charles. No. Charles, I think, well, number one, he was a gentleman.
Uh-huh.
Always. Number two, he was a soldier's soldier. But he would never talk about it. He had the Croix de Guerre and the Silver Star. He was in a tank at the Battle of, Arnhem in Holland. And he went behind German lines with his tank, and he piled 23 grunts on top of it and took them home. That was Charles, but he would never take credit for anything. And he always promoted my work, every chance he had, and without letting people know, he was the man behind it. He never let me know the things that he did for my work. And he was close friends with Lester Hemingway. In fact, that's how I met Lester Hemingway, through Charles. We lived in Fort Lauderdale, but no, Charles was a very good writer, great sense of humor, and he'd do wonderful imitations of John Wayne.
Charles had
this great sense of humor, just. You know, when you say Charles' name, people smile. I always say, "Do you know Charles?" I say, "Yep." No, he was a good man.
I have not read any of his novels. Is there one that I should start with?
Well, I would think of it this way. Charles' titles say things that only Charles would say. Only Charles would name a title, a book, New Hope for the Dead. And then he used to call it the ultimate self-help book. That was Charles. And then Charles, ask Dennis McMillan about that. You know, Dennis published some of Charles's work.
Okay.
But Charles, I figured if Charles told me this, or if Dennis quoted Charles saying this, Charles said, "I waited 20 years to get a review in the New York Times, and the reviewer said, this was the opening of the review. A moron like Charles Williford's protagonist has no business using psychoanalysis in his crime solving. It was, no, a clod, that was it. A clod like Charles Williford's protagonist has no business being a detective." That was it. Charles said, "I waited 20 years for this."
Jim, you know, Jim, when you laugh so hard, you start getting a side split. Well, I got one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, Charles was a good fellow. But his book, A Soldier's Story, which was autobiographical, is a very good book. And a better book, and I think his best, was one titled I Was Looking for a Street.
Oh.
And it's his autobiography as a hobo during the Great Depression.
Okay.
He ran away from an orphanage when he was 15 years old, and he rode the rods. And it's the story of his odyssey across America. It's the best. I blurbed it.
Really?
It's the best work I have ever read about the Depression other than either Grapes of Wrath or, Steinbeck's other great book.
Cannery Row?
Mice and Men.
Oh, Mice and Men.
It's on that level. In fact, in the blurb, that's what I compared it with. It's that good, and the writing is that good. And it's always been ignored, but it's an honest portrayal, I think, of the Depression era and the privation and survival. It's a very fine book, but it's undoubtedly his best.
Don't you usually just have an idea and then you just kind of keep going from there? You don't have it laid out in advance. It's just you have an idea and then you just go.
You're correct.
Okay.
I don't have a plan. And I write things in longhand, but I usually see maybe two scenes into the story, but I never know the story. I never know where it's going.
Uh-huh. And looking forward, are you working on something?
I just finished a new book, writing a new book. It's titled The Pillars of Heaven, and it's about migrant farm workers in Colorado in 1962. It's a good book. Boy, wow. It's the sequel to The Jealous Kind.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's really good to know. And that one's finished.
Yep, sure is. It's. I'm really proud of it. I'm proud of a private cathedral, too. It's this is what other people say, and they all do. I mean, it's a publishing house, they say this is the best of the Robichaux series. I think they're correct.
Well, Jim, I want to give you a little plug here. You've been doing all these online events, and I looked at your website, and I see you had a conversation with John Grisham.
Yeah.
And another with Michael Connelly. And then two really amazing big ones. You've got Lee Child coming up on Tuesday, August 25th, and then Saturday, August 29th. In conversation with Stephen King. Whoa.
Yeah.
That's pretty
cool.
They're
all fine gentlemen, and they're very fine men.
And if listeners want to watch any of these, they can through the miracle of modern technology. Just go to Jim's website at jamesleeburke.com, and you can get all the info. And while you're there, you could also pick up a signed copy of Jim's latest book.
Well, I hope people enjoy it. I think it's a pretty good story.
Jim, it's always so good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Well, same here, Vic. So talk to you later.
And you've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO for The Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.